Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hi. Welcome to the Beacon Group. In an effort to lessen distraction to others and respect our speakers, we ask that you please take a moment before to silence and put away your cell phones and other electronic devices. In addition, we ask that if you have kosher-approved food and drink, to respect our host, the temple. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting space so all who wish to recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of the great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety and AA, our common welfare. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer.
God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you. Okay, do we have someone who will read the steps?
I think that's me.
Okay. Your name? Jim. This is Jim. He's going to read the steps.
Hi, my name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, hey, Jim.
The 12 steps. Here are the steps we took as suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to other human beings the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and we were wrong. When we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will and for the power to carry it out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thanks, Jim. Okay, the format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Emily.
Hi guys, my name's Emily. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Emily.
Is this on?
Yeah.
It
is. Very grateful to be here at an AA meeting. Never thought that that was something that I would say and actually mean. And, having come into this program and finally surrendering to it and trying to work this program to the best of my willingness, I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink since July 13, 2015. And prior to that, just had little bits of sobriety here and there, and the any time before that was in high school for a soccer contract. 30 days, and I made it. And I remember I said to myself, see, I'm not an alcoholic. And I think I was 15. So my father came into this program about that time when I was 15. And I remember when I was younger, I would watch him drink, and I would think to myself, like, I'm never going to be like that. But then, like, also, I can't wait to drink, which is, you know, a really strange thing. And I truly thought that I had the choice, and I thought that he was making a choice. And, you know, my experience looks like I drank more than I intended on most occasions, and I did things that I did not plan on doing. And I never, you know, well, I eventually tried to stop, but for a long time I didn't really try and stop. And alcohol just worked for me, you know, and I used a lot of outside issues as well that enhanced the alcohol, and that's just what worked for me. You know, it's like when I drank, like the craziness, the darkness, the thoughts in my head were just kind of like quieted, and I could like be myself and I could like myself. And it was like I would look forward to that next drink. And so, you know, fast forward, I mean, I always surrounded myself with people that drank like me. If you told me I drank too much, I'm not going to hang out with you anymore. I always managed to keep things on the outside looking okay. And my parents would kind of like drop hints and be like, you know, I think you're drinking too much. I think you need to like lay off. And I'd be like, well, I'm getting the grades that you want me to get. You know, I'm playing sports. I got into college. You know, I can't imagine them dealing with me. And so I would always have these excuses and justifications, and I'm not as bad as this person, and I didn't crash my car drunk, and I didn't get a DUI. So like I had these justifications. And you know, the progression just continuously took over, and it was like, well, I'm in college, this is what people in college do, and I'm in my early 20s, this is what people in their early 20s do. And then it was like, well, now I'm kind of drinking by myself, and it's progressively getting worse. And then I started trying to stop, and it really never occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to. And so that started every Sunday. It was like, Monday's gonna be day one, I'm gonna do it. And I was gonna do it myself, right? I was raised, like, we didn't talk about our feelings, we didn't go see any like shrinks, you know, we just had to be tough and get through it and be a little bit stronger. So that's what I would tell myself, like, you just have to be stronger, you have to have more willpower. And I would fail most times by 12 o'clock, you know, on my lunch break. And some days I'd make it to Thursday, and I would be feeling a little better, and I'd be like, you could do this. And I'd get out of work, and I'd be like, well, maybe I should just take, like, the road that goes by the liquor store, you know. And so it wasn't until I was introduced to this that I was willing to do something different. I wound up in treatment. You know, it was after about 6 months of trying to come up with a way that I could kill myself that might look like an accident, so my parents wouldn't be like completely destroyed. And so it was just like, I didn't want to stop drinking. I didn't want to give that up, but I wanted to stop wanting to kill myself. And so I wound up in treatment, and I did not belong there, and I was talking to all these people, and I'm still trying to justify, make excuses, and if you had this person die, you would drink the way I did. If you had my life, you'd drink the way I did. And we started going through this book, and there's a part in the second foreword, and it talks about Bob not being able to give himself to this program until he really surrenders. And I remember I was 3 weeks sober, and I'm in a group, and the gentleman's running the group, and I'm in my head, you know, no idea what he's talking about, because I'm thinking, when I get out of here, my parents are going to be like watching me, they're probably going to take my debit card, and I'm thinking of an elderly neighbor that I could break into their house and steal some like cash or jewelry so I could get what I needed when I got out. And they were telling me, you know, you should stay here for longer, you should go to sober living, you should do this. And so I'm sitting there, and he goes, yeah, Emily, I'm talking to you. You got a bad plan. And I was like, what? He's like, you got a bad plan. And like in my head, I'm thinking about this, and he's talking about I'm not listening to any of their suggestions. And that like hit me. I couldn't blame the drinking. I couldn't blame, I had no excuse because I was physically sober and these were my thoughts. And that's when I like fully surrendered and I was like, I am completely run by this thing. There's no way I can do this by myself. And I think it was that point that I really was able to surrender and really start doing this. And they told me to pray, and that looked like, please effing help me, you know, for a couple weeks. That's all I had. And I started going through this work. And they said, get a home group, and I got a home group. And they said, get a job there, I got a job there. They said, get a sponsor, I got a sponsor. You know, as soon as I had my spiritual experience, they said, you sponsor other people, you're qualified. I was a few months sober, and I'm like, ooh, I don't know if that's a good idea, right? And the book doesn't say, you know, take a break and focus on yourself. It says dive into helping others. And those are things that, like, I've never stopped doing, you know? I've always had a sponsor, and I've been sponsoring women since then. It was like October 2015. And it was October 2015 where I read my my fourth step to my sponsor, and a couple of days went by, and I realized, like, I hadn't thought about drinking. And that hadn't happened to me since, I don't know, end of middle school, you know? Like, that obsession of, like, when am I going to get it? Where can I get it? And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is working. And it gave me that willingness to keep going. And I do not do this perfectly, you know. I have skipped prayers. I have done, like, the bare minimum, like, you know, oh, I slept too late. Let me just rush through this or not do it at all, you know. But I've always tried to stay in the middle of AA and in the middle of that triangle. And I just try and listen to the people that come before me, because the longer I stay sober, I realize the less I know, you know. And I heard, like, I have to remain teachable. And that's what I try and do, because the minute that I think I've got this, you know, I'm screwed. And that's something that I've never had happen to me in my sobriety. Like, yeah, you know what, I think you got it now. I'll have fleeting thoughts. Someone will be sharing, and I'll be like, oh, maybe you overreacted. You weren't that bad. You know, you didn't go to 70 treatment centers like that person. And then it's like I think about it, and I'm in AA, and I have a sponsor that I talk to, and it's like, oh, no. You know, and I'll share, and someone will be like, oh my gosh, I identified with everything you said. And I'm like, darn it, you know, I'm right where I belong. You know, they had the same experience. And I truly thought the idea of a higher power, you know, saving me, like I've envisioned it coming down to save me. And I'm like, it's not going to work for me, you know. And once I had that willingness to really seek this program, I've just been seeking that higher power and trying to get to know that higher power better and do their will for me. And that does not always look like what Emily wants to do. And Emily's very stubborn, hard-headed, wants to do what she wants to do, you know? Oh, I had a long day. I deserve to go home and whatever, you know, rest, go to bed early, watch Netflix. And I have to remember that, like, this program has been held up, and it was available to me in 2015. And like, I look at my nephews and I think of all the people that are still out there. And it's my responsibility to keep coming, keep sharing the message, keep putting my hand out whenever anyone that has a desire to stop drinking, you know, puts their hand out to me. And how selfish of me, right? I thought you could graduate and like a couple years in. And luckily, that's not the case, right? I plan to keep coming, God willing. And I think as long as I stay in the middle and keep seeking this higher power, you know, I think my life's going to continue to get better. You know, my dad, he is quite a few more years than me, and he says it just keeps getting better. And then he said he met someone with 55 years, and they said it keeps getting better. So I trust that. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. We will now observe the seven tradition. The seven tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside. Sorry about that. Contributions. Password, sorry. Declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seven tradition digitally on Venmo. There's a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 a month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Ramiro?
Megan.
Thank you, Megan. With any questions, we thank you in advance for your generosity. Also, AA has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Dean has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
They're in the book.
Oh, do I just read off the thing?
You can.
Oh, okay. Hey, my name is Dean. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
Dean. So, traditions. Okay, number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Number two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he presents himself to the group in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants who do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting others or AA as a whole, or other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige diverge from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever unprofessional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on such issues, hence the AA name ought never be brought into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thanks, Dean. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting which meets on the third Wednesday of each month directly after the meeting in person and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? Okay. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Danny?
Danny.
Hey everybody, my name is Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Danny.
My sobriety date is August 3rd, 2011. It's been a great experience being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a great person when I'm drinking, and I'm not a happy person when I'm sober without AA. And I've discovered that along the way, both before and after I decided to come in here for the last time. I grew up in central Massachusetts, and I'll use a line I've heard out there and in Boston. I didn't drink in kindergarten, but I sure could have used one. And that really resonates with me. I was an uncomfortable kid, and I didn't know I was that uncomfortable because that was just life. That was just how I felt. I felt like when I closed my bedroom door that everybody stopped talking, and that they were talking about me, and I didn't fit in. I grew up in maybe a dysfunctional household, but the longer I stay in AA and hear people like you guys, I realize it wasn't that dysfunctional. But I certainly felt like it was, and I didn't realize how uncomfortable I was until I drank when I was about 12 years old, 13 years old. And it just rolled all my problems off my shoulders. I was one of those people that felt like I could breathe and I could be myself. I could be a version of myself that I thought the world found acceptable. And so I started drinking early, and I was sold. It worked for me, like the previous speaker said. There were girls that I had my eye on in grade school that would come up to me in someone's garage in Central Mass and say, like, "You're funny." And I'm like, good luck convincing me to stop drinking when that's the result. Because that doesn't happen that much. And that's all a 12-year-old wants to hear is someone he finds attractive compliment him. And I was sold. You could not convince me. There's a guy, we call him Cookie, my home group's knuckleheads in Somerville, but his name's Mike. And he told his parents when they confronted him about his drinking and drug use as a 15-year-old, he said, "If you think I'm going to stop, you've bumped your head." And I'm like, that's something for a 15-year-old to tell his parents. But I get it. No one was going to convince me otherwise. I was a part of the DARE program in Massachusetts. I sang songs. We will not do drugs. Was the song we came up with? We were budding creatives at that time. But I knew it was all bad, and I tried it and decided against that logic. And it worked for a while, and I would have bad nights, and I would chalk it up to like teenage hijinks, you know, this stuff happens. And then when it got into my 20s, I started doing other stuff and this, and it's like spinning a wheel, you know, that bankrupt on Wheel of Fortune. More and more plates of bankrupt started getting put on that wheel, and every night. And then at the end of my drinking, it was like, I hope I land on something that isn't bankrupt. I hope that I don't wake up with guilt. Like, I would just wake up, not remember anything, and just feel this pit in my stomach, like, what did I do? And when I knew none of it was good. It wasn't like I helped anybody that night. It was I did selfish things or hurt people, and it was sickening. And I've heard this expression, and forgive me if I'm not getting it right. I think it's water torch. I think it's attributed to some country. But at the end of my drinking, it was waking up, cursing myself in the mirror that I did it again, and going to work, trying to make it look like I'd been there for a while, show up late, try to sneak in without anybody seeing me, and then have people make comments about, you had a rough one last night. It doesn't matter what day it was. Or like, you smell like a brewery. You must have had a night. And that was just like, you know, I had pants. I worked at a firm, and I had a hole in my pants. This pair of pants was my last pair, like the pair of pants you use last before you do laundry. And I knew there was a hole in my pants. And I knew that people knew there was a hole in my pants. But as long as they didn't confront me, we didn't have a problem. I didn't care what people thought of me. Until someone said, you know that there's a huge hole in your pants, and we need you to wear other pants. So that's the pants story. But that's the kind of stuff. But I would be in a panic in the morning about my drinking, and I would swear it off, like, I'm going to change. Man, you're getting too old for this. Like, this isn't cute anymore. It's not college. It's not high school. Like, it's starting to get ugly. I would meet women who cared about me, and they would confront me on my drinking, and it wouldn't be like, ooh, this person's confronting my drinking. My thought was, we don't have any chemistry. Because I love my lifestyle. And that's who I am. That's who I am. And if you can't get on board with who I am, you can hit the road. Yeah. And so, but the things that were really getting to me were like not showing up on Mother's Day. My mom recently passed away, and I was able to make amends and be a part of her life. Not showing up to work on time, clients worried, family worried, girlfriends worried, friends worried. And I had jackpots. I got a hotel evacuated. Some guy tried to rob me. I got a gun put to my head by both him and the police. It was crazy. Like, things that are like, you should stop drinking. But just not showing up for my life, not becoming the man I wanted to be, that I felt I could be. Every day was like, I think it's Japanese water torture. Dripping beads of water on your head. Not a big deal at first, right? But after 2 weeks, you're kind of begging for someone to take your life. And that's what it felt like for me. At the end of my drinking, it was just another day of not showing up and not being who I was meant to be. And so eventually I come into AA, and I'm scared of everybody. I'm not scared of people. I'm not scared. But I didn't want to, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to be Ned Flanders to get sober. That's the person I'm going to have to be. And that's the decision I made. I was like, all right, this is getting so ugly, and I don't like this person I'm becoming so much that I'll be Ned Flanders. I'll go, I'll read your book, I'll sit down, we'll pray, and we'll hold hands. And I stuck around for a while, and I went to meetings. I didn't do the steps, didn't get a sponsor. And I raised my hand at a men's meeting. It was at the Paula Center near the State House. And I said, like, all right, you guys tell me to be honest here. I'm going to be really, I'm going to be wicked honest right now. I'm not having a lot of fun. I feel better. I'm not getting drunk. But I'm not having fun in AA. Like, you guys, these guys would, like, fall asleep and then wake up in the middle of the meeting and be like, gratitude, gratitude. And I'm like, I want to feel like that. That's what I was trying to get to with all the other stuff. So if I can get to that with sobriety, I'll take it. And they approached me after the meeting. What they said was, keep coming. And I hate it. That's like the middle finger for AA speak. Keep coming, pal. But people approach me after the meeting and they're like, all right, well, you're not having a good time. You're not happy. Where are you at in the steps? Well, I don't know. I'm not doing the steps. Well, you got a sponsor? Yeah. Well, how often do you call them? Once every 3 months, maybe. And they're like, well, why don't you do the steps of this 12-step program with a sponsor, like we've been telling you, maybe you should, and then complain about how it doesn't work, but you really haven't tried the program of Alcoholics Anonymous yet. And so I did. I found a new sponsor who was active in the work, who took me through the steps that I didn't think were going to work, and they did. And it's been 12 years. I didn't think the promises were going to come true. Fear of economic insecurity and people. People and economic insecurity will leave us. That's never going to happen. I was $350,000 in debt from the schooling I had. And, well, I'm out of debt now. Not saying you're all going to get out of debt. The rates are terrible. But pretty much all the promises came true. And I thought it was just like hocus pocus. Like it was just all gobbledygook, everybody holding hands, and all these promises were just BS that everybody told themselves until they forgot they told themselves that, and then whatever. And it's true. And now I'm trying to hang on. I have four sponsees. We go, I'm just, not to brag, but I just met with a sponsee before. Yeah. I'm pretty sure he's going to talk about me the next time he gets a coin. But I still have an ego problem. But the point is that I work with guys. I'm part of a home group. I go to meetings. I'm a new dad. And man, has that tested my serenity. You know, there's not enough time. It's not about me anymore. It's about this little guy. And life is really good. Being sober in AA, and I didn't think I would ever say that and mean it either. So, thank you.
Thanks, Danny. Keep coming. We encourage. There we go again. Sorry about that. Something.
Oh, it's all right.
Okay, I got it. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in this marker is over the word, sorry, fully in our meetings and have a service position. If you would like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Romero.
Yeah. Here we go.
After the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Arisa.
And I'm most definitely an alcoholic.
Hi,
the date of my last drink was October the 13th of 1993, and for that I am truly, truly grateful. So last weekend was 30 years of sobriety, one day at a time. And for those of you who might be visiting and don't know, this is my home group. And I love everybody that's here. And thank you to the other speakers. And my friend who's here from California, who used to call, he was my uncle for a long time, and sober brother and sober traveler. You know, I mean, I love this life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and similar to what you heard earlier, that was not the girl who walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I don't know about you, but I never had a day before I really got sober that I thought, you know, today'd be a good day to be sober. That just was not the way this redhead thought. You know, I mean, from the time I started drinking, my main thought was, how do I do that again? And how do I do more of that again? And, you know, how do I get you out of my way so I can do even more of that? Right? And that's how I rolled. I got sober and I grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas. If you don't know where that is about 4 hours south of Houston, about 4 hours north of Mexico. It's one big long sand dune, basically, 125 miles long. And there were banana trees in the backyard, palm trees in the front yard. My mom used to say, you're dressed up if you're in shoes. And that's where I made most of my damage. I had, somebody said something about a dysfunctional family. I didn't know I had a dysfunctional family. I learned a lot more about just how dysfunctional my family was when I got here. Because I don't know about you, but normal is whatever is happening to me. I just didn't have that, you know, ability. I knew things were different. I knew they weren't right. You know, I had a little bit of a sense of that. But when I was growing up, nobody talked about what happened behind closed doors. You know, like I got in trouble for saying something to somebody once by my mother. And we just don't talk about those things, right? I didn't really understand that we had the family disease of alcoholism in my family. My grandfather did get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he died with almost 4 years of sobriety, but my mom had moved out before he got sober. So we had just a whole lot of the isms. We had a whole lot of the ick. My dad's the adult child of a missionary. My mom's the adult child of an alcoholic. That's not a good cocktail. You know, it was a really violent home. It was a really dysfunctional home. There was a lot of stuff that happened there that shouldn't happen to anybody. And I tell you that for one reason only, because it has nothing to do with my drinking. Nothing. Nothing that happened to me growing up made me an alcoholic. What I found out is what made me an alcoholic is from the time I had that first drink when I was 15 years old, alcohol did something for me that it doesn't do for other people. The third guy on the front row over here, that's my husband, David. Hi, David. David is not an alcoholic. When David drinks, you should watch, it's very interesting. When David drinks, he gets this slightly tipsy, out of control feeling, which, get this, he doesn't like. So you know what he does? He stops. I know, we should all, like, David, you know, just keep going, you can get there, don't quit before the miracle. He doesn't get the same effect produced that I do when I drink. When I drink, I don't get slightly tipsy and out of control. I mean, maybe I get in control. When I drink, I can handle it, whatever it is. And if alcohol doesn't do for you what it does for me, you'll never let it do to you the kind of stuff I let it do to me. And alcohol took me to some really dark places. Within just a few months of me picking up that very first drink, I was already in Austin, Texas, drinking in bars on 6th Street. You're not allowed to be on the premises at the age of 15, but I'm 5'11", so that's okay, right? first bar, I get abducted and raped. I don't get small problems when I drink. I'm the girl who's like, if lightning's gonna strike, I suggest you step away from the redhead, for your own safety. I mean, I bad things happen. Anybody who's looking at me knows, man, that girl should not drink. Bad stuff happens when I drink. I get alcohol poisoning on a regular basis. I have done the shake, rattle, and roll at home a whole bunch of times. If you haven't had the DTs, man, I didn't know I'd had the DTs. See, I never got to go to detox, except to speak for AA. I never got to go to a sober house except to speak for AA. You know, I mean, I didn't get medical attention. I didn't get any of those things. I mean, I didn't understand that I had alcoholism. My mother would, you know, step over me and say things like, well, maybe if you suffer enough, you won't do it anymore. Because even though her dad was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, she didn't understand really that alcoholism was a disease, and I certainly didn't know that I had it. And everybody was looking at me and thinking that I was just selfish and I was self-centered. Not that, that's true. That is absolutely true, but I was totally the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I mean, I am class president. I'm voted most likely to succeed. I mean, I've got about a 99.9 GPA. I'm going to a great college, and I'm trying to kill myself on a regular basis, and at night, I mean, it's like the dark angel is definitely out, you know? I mean, my favorite drink, I was an underage alcoholic. You know, my favorite drink is, what do you got? What do you got? You know, I mean, Mad Dog 2020, Everclear Punch, I do not care, right? And one is until it's gone. I don't understand people like David who keeps corks and, you know, puts argon gas in because the wine might go bad before he gets back to it. And then sometimes he opens the bottle and he goes, yeah, it just doesn't taste good. And he dumps the whole thing in. That's alcohol abuse, guys. That's a drinking problem. I don't know about you, but I don't have a drinking problem. I've never had a drinking problem, and I don't expect I'm ever going to get a drinking problem. What I have is a sobriety problem. I have never had anything more painful than being stark raving sober. You know, I hear a lot of things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't like because they're not at AA, really, you know, and that's fine. I mean, if it works for you, don't get me wrong. God bless you. Go in peace. It just doesn't work for me. Things like, God will never give you more than you can handle. Not my experience. My experience is that breathing in and out for 24 hours a day is more than this alcoholic can handle. I need something to get the me off of me. I've never, ever just been okay with the chatter that's in my head. It's like 1,000 gerbils, and they all have different personalities. You know how they talk about stage characters in the big book? Like, I got stage characters, and they all fight all the time. I mean, really, it's so noisy in there. And all I want is for this to quiet down, and when I drink, I can finally just be okay. I mean, I get all the ninth step promises when I drink. I do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. You know, I know how I, you know, comprehend the word serenity. Absolutely. I know peace. You know, fear of economic insecurity does leave me if I drink enough, you know, and I definitely know how my experience can benefit everybody. I get all those promises if I drink enough. But the problem is there's some side effects, like I was saying, from drinking, you know, things like really, really bad side effects. And I really thought that I was drinking because of my dad. I really thought that I was drinking because of what happened to me. So I made my first geographic. I went to AA as soon as I graduated from high school because that's normal, right? You know, graduate one week, go to AA the next Monday. You know, that was my, what happened to me. But you know, there were only about 6 people in that room, and they were all way older than I am now. And they were talking about sleeping under bridges, and they were talking about losing jobs, and they were talking about losing marriages, and I had not had any of those things. And I didn't identify. I didn't understand what alcoholism is. I didn't get from them this idea of, you know, the mental obsession. That when really, really bad things happen to you, normal people, if you drink, normal people don't drink again. But when people talk to me about maybe you should look at your drinking, I'm thinking, maybe I need new friends. You know, like, it's time to change. Like, no, you change, you know. I am okay with you not caring, you not liking my drinking. I really am. You can leave. The alcohol's gonna stay. So I made it to my first geographic. I didn't know it was a geographic. I called it going to college. So I went to college. And the problem with college is there are a lot of people drinking in college. And so I made it one semester, and I couldn't stay sober because people kept drinking around me. And if I don't drink when other people are around me, I either hate you and begin to kind of be a little bit, what would you call it? Well, let's just say serial killer, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, I think about killing everyone because I hate you, because I hate me. I really hate you if you get to drink because I feel like I'm missing out. Being sentenced to sobriety is hell, you know? And so I moved off campus. My plan for not drinking is do not be anywhere near alcohol, right? You know, like, I get a long-distance boyfriend, so when you get asked out, you have a reason not to go. You know, I mean, I have all these things. Like, and every now and then I'd have a little slip, a little oopsie-daisy, but I didn't get the DTs. So that's my definition of social drinking. You know, like, if there are invisible things crawling on you 3 days later, good job, you know. And what happened was I started doing the things that we do to try and treat this thing in my head, because I got what they were saying in AA. Like, I understood that I didn't drink like other people. And I really kind of believed this whole, you know, hole in the soul, and like, you know, maybe it's a God thing, you know, and but unmanageable. I mean, if what had happened to me had happened to you, I think I'm doing really good, don't you? I mean, come on, give me a little bit of credit here. So I didn't get the unmanageability part, which is why I left AA, really. But actually, that's not even true. There was no internet back then, okay? And when I walked into that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the only meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I knew of, because my mom dropped me off there. And they didn't give me what I think is the most important piece of literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, the meeting list book. They told me to buy a big book. I did. It was $5. I still have it to this day, because that was a lot of money back then. But they didn't tell me that there were other meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not understand that there could possibly even be other people under the age of 80 getting sober, you know? And I didn't know that there could be meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Houston, Texas. Who knew? Of course, when I eventually got sober, there was one across the street from my dorm, but I didn't know that. And it never crossed my mind once in 3 years to look for an AA meeting. I don't know about that. But anyway, I started doing things like, I went to therapy. I'm taking religion classes. I'm chanting with the Hare Krishnas. I'm doing yoga and Pilates. I'm vegan. You know, I'm doing all these things to treat this alcoholism. I'm taking antidepressants, you know. I go down to South America. I paddle up the Amazon. I'm swimming with the piranhas. Now, all these things they're good things to do. Okay, except for the piranhas, you know, but they don't treat alcoholism. They're not bad things. They just don't treat alcoholism. And fortunately, I had a very bad accident down in South America where I broke my wrist. I'm a right-handed artist with a stick shift car, and I cannot go back to college because I can't paint and I can't drive, and all of a sudden I'm back at my parents' house, and I haven't been back at my parents' house in 3 years. And I don't have one more coping skill than I had back then. And what happened to me within a couple of weeks, I'm drinking again. That's what happened. Because I don't know how to deal with life on life's terms. All I knew how to do at best was hold my breath. How long can I hold my breath this time? 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. That was it. And then it would be another, oh my goodness. And that time I ended up with alcohol poisoning after drinking for like, I don't know, I went out like maybe 3 times and then I got alcohol poisoning again. And very fortunate for me, I was put in touch with somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous who helped me to understand that when you, no sane person would decide to drink again with the kind of consequences that I get. Nobody would. Like, that's just, I mean, Russian roulette every time, right? But hey, you know, you might get a blank this time. Let's go for it. Like, that's just not sane. You know, they would say things like, you know, you're either stupid or crazy. I'm not stupid. And I didn't like the idea of crazy. But when you guys helped me to understand that to have that obsession of the mind is what it's really about. See, I had to get really clear on that. The thing is that, you know, I wanted to kill myself, but I'm not very creative and I wasn't allowed to watch much television, but I would sit in my 1976 Cadillac at this T-junction that overlooks the Gulf of Mexico, okay? And it's not a big cliff, I want to be clear about this, but I thought it would do the job, okay? At least the car would sink quickly and I'd be, you know. And I'd be sitting in that T-junction waiting for the light to turn green, because you wouldn't want to run the red light, you know, on the way to suicide. So I'm a good girl, remember? And I'd be sitting there, and here's what a miracle looked like in my little alcoholic brain. There's a keg party out at the beach. I mean, that is a miracle. I didn't have to die that night. Alcohol saved my life. I can't tell you how many times. Because I couldn't take the pain of being sober any longer. And when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys helped me to understand that I had a physical allergy, that once I started drinking, that I lost all power, choice, and control over how much I drank. Thank you. And that I also had this mental obsession that would take me back to it each time, that life would feel so unbearable that I would end up drinking again. Like, that's what it takes to be hopeless. You have to have both. And I was very fortunate to walk into what I very lovingly call a very fundamentalist meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, where there were a whole lot of people carrying some very big books, and they made sure that I got a sponsor. They appointed me a sponsor, in fact. She had 2 months of sobriety. Anybody here with 2 months or under? Yeah, 2 months, there you go. Can you imagine, right? I mean, this woman had been a chronic relapser, okay? And she was back and she was doing her amends, because she was a really low bottom alcoholic, and they knew that, you know, she needed to jump back in and get through this work. She was gonna die. And they also knew that if she didn't start helping somebody, she was gonna die. So they gave her me. I mean, how bad could she do, right? I mean, you know, like, what are the chances I'm gonna stay anyway? By that time, I'm 21 years old. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that she's still here, and so am I, 30 years later. And it was not a perfect, you know, run through the steps that time, but she told me a whole lot of things that are still with me today. Things like, when your sponsor tells you to do something, there's only one question that you can respond with. And that is, exactly how high would you like me to jump? All other questions are beside the point. You know, like, the Nike ad had just come out, and she would just go, Nike, meaning just do it. Nike. And then everything was a God thing. She had a big twin. Very annoying. And she would say things like, if you're not there from prayer to prayer, it's my opinion you were not there, and I had to go to at least 90 meetings in 90 days. 180 was better, but there are two times to go to a meeting, when you want to and when you don't want to. Or noon and 8 o'clock. That's when our meetings were mostly. And, you know, I was really fortunate that I was so broken. I was so out of answers that I did everything that she told me to, that I heard. Did you get that? You know, I really thought that I was such a willing sponsee. I'm sure of it, maybe. I mean, that's my recollection. I don't know about you, but I see myself a little differently than the world sometimes does. But she did tell me, she said, you know, I think if you don't work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to drink again. And I really didn't want to drink again. I was really finally done. And she took me through the steps incredibly imperfectly. I did my first fifth step on Christmas Eve, and then we burned it. And then I moved back to Houston for the next semester. And I get to Houston, and I ask another person to sponsor me. This woman has 5 years. She knows everything about AA. She knows the big book cold. She is awesome, right? I mean, so funny. Anyway, and the first thing she asked me, she said, so what step are you on? And I said, I'm on step 6. And she said, oh, no. I'm like, no, really, I'm on step 6. And she said, honey, nobody's on step 6. And so she's like, that means you're on 1. And I was that was a big AA resentment right there. But I'm so glad that she took me back through, because she actually understood the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's the one who really helped me to love the process of, you know, reading this book for myself. Did not let anybody else tell me what's in this book. To not let anybody else read my big book for me, but to have a direct experience with this book. She did not sit there and read it with me. That was not a thing where I got sober. They said, go read the book, and then we're going to talk about it so we can make sure you know what the heck it actually said. You know, and we did a lot of deep, deep work. And that fourth step, which, you know, I thought I'd done the fourth step, but then everybody in the meetings are talking about their patterns. I didn't have any patterns. And, you know, we burned my fifth step also, you know, so I had no list, I had nothing, you know, like, I didn't know what people were talking about with patterns or any of that. I mean, honestly, it was some worksheet. I don't know where it came from, and I don't know what it said, because we burned it. but it got me in enough, because I was willing to go to any lengths. Even if it didn't make any sense, I did everything that she told me to do, I was willing to do. And then I took that same attitude with the next one. But when we got into that imagery, I went and spent the weekend with my sponsor for my fifth step. And she lived out in Clear Lake, which was about, I don't know, an hour and a half from home or something like that. And she had me reading this inventory. And I'm reading about my dad, and I always thought the fifth step was, okay, I've been blaming my dad, now I have to take all the blame, right? And I told her things like, I resent my dad because he dragged me down the stairs by my hair, you know, he ripped my clothes off of me in public, he beat me, you know, like, there was some bad stuff that happened. And then I said, and then what I did was, I antagonized him. And she stopped me dead in my tracks, and she said, that's not what we're talking about here. That's not what this is. She said, you were a child, right? I was like, yeah. And she said, okay, as a child, you don't carry any of that blame. That's not on you. That's him. That's the world, and those people are often quite wrong. And there's a period there. But if that's as far as I ever get, then I stay locked in jail. You see, I hated my father. And one of my greatest fears was that he was going to get off the hook. That I needed to make sure that the world knew just how wrong he had been. And so I couldn't forgive him. And what she helped me to understand is that instead, this had nothing to do. I was supposed to disregard my father entirely and resolutely look for my own mistakes. That, you know, what my dad did to me then was wrong. But my question was, how are you using it as your get-out-of-jail-free card today? How are you using it to rationalize the things that you don't want to do or that you do want to do? Or how are you using it to persecute other people you're blaming for something somebody else did? I mean, I was not nice to men for a long time. And that's the truth, you know, and because I didn't know how to not be angry at everybody for what a couple of people had done, right? And so she helped me to really take a look at with I being the woman that I said I wanted to be. You know, I a lot of times in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was doing some inventory with somebody recently, and they were talking about their dad, and you know, she said, well, any decent human being would right, you know? And I stopped her right there. And I said, wait a minute, you know, any decent human being who has been through what you've been through might act that way. But what have they been through? See, my sponsor told me that it was my job now. I'd been the lawyer from the prosecution my whole life, okay? And now it was time for me to cross the courtroom and become the lawyer for the defense. How do I try to actually understand what my father has been through? That in truth, my father has jumped light years ahead of the abuse that he was brought up in. My father was born in South America. His parents weren't really there. You know, he was shooting pigeons to feed the other kids, right? He grew up in a world that I can't even quite understand, with a whole lot of, frankly, you know, religious stuff put on him too. And the truth is, without a program, without a sponsor, without therapy, without antidepressants, without the Hare Krishnas, without all these things, somehow or another, my father didn't do it nearly as bad as what he was given. That my father didn't do the best that they did the best they can. We say that a lot, like it's, you know, almost like a bad thing. But the truth is, my father did better than he should have been able to do. You know, that my sponsor sent me home to start thinking about, what's your dad done right? And you know, my list for my dad, what he'd done right, had one thing on it. That was as far as I could get that first time, right? And it was that he taught me to draw. I'm an artist. And you know, my dad is the person who has always told me to go, do it. Do what you want to do, you know? And today I have a remarkably good relationship with my father because I did actually want, by the end of that, if you've done a thorough fifth step, like, you really want to get your character defects removed. I mean, it's really uncomfortable to hang on to those things. See, 6 and 7, I thought I'd been doing basically 6 and 7 my whole life. Try harder, do better. Doesn't that sound like a good slogan? Try harder, do better. That is not 6 and 7. It is let go and let God. That these problems are not mine anymore. How do I stop? See, when I came into AA, I came to AA really to fix me. I mean, fortunately, there were people there who said, darling, you've been doing that your whole life. The only thing that's gotten you is worse. Why don't you stop? You are, you know, look in the mirror. You're the problem. Thank you. That instead, I needed to get busy loving you. I was so sure that if you loved me enough, I'd be okay. And they said, no, honey, if you love the world enough, it's going to melt that polarized cap from around your heart. That's the deal. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. Alcoholics Anonymous gets called a mutual aid society, but that's not my experience. My experience is Alcoholics Anonymous' program where we help others to get out of God's way. because I need a spiritual experience. I need a God to do it for me. Because what I found was my third column gets activated if I'm not holding God's hand. You know, and I didn't want anything to do with God when I got here. My first God was good orderly direction, a group of drunks, and all that fun stuff, right? I mean, and I had all these friends who had such great relationships with God, and I just didn't really want that. Because I had a really old idea that was not actually an old idea, because it was alive and well in my head and still in my heart. That I, one of my best, tastiest character defects is assuming malice. I know what you're thinking. You know what they're thinking. But have you ever noticed they're never thinking anything good? They're never thinking anything good. I never assume you meant to say, you know, be nice to me. It's always, why didn't that person say hello? I don't remember the 42 that did. I remember the one who didn't. You know, I'm the girl with the Eeyore cloud. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, people talked about there are two types of people. There are victims and there are, anybody heard this? Nobody ever heard the volunteers? Yeah, I hate that. I hate that. Not my experience. I mean, it's what I got told, but I didn't like it, and it's not my truth. My truth is there are two types of people. There are victims and there are people who've been victimized. And the difference is, a victim, it's because it becomes who you are, and you're waiting for them to do it again. And it's a bad day for a victim when, you know, nobody does anything to them. But if you've been victimized, it's something that happened to you in the past, and you get to live free today. You see, I was still a victim because I'm sitting outside of that jail cell in that dank, dark, ugly basement prison, making sure my dad doesn't get out one day early. And I can't go live my life. I can't be happy, joyous, and free, because what would happen if he got out? What would happen if he got out? See, I thought forgiveness meant he gets off the hook. Isn't that what it's about? I mean, saying I'm sorry, my ninth step amends, right? I thought, I'm good at saying I'm sorry. I don't know about you, but, you know, a couple flips of the hair, and I was young, and, you know, it's easy to get off. I'm good at saying I'm sorry. I can make a good apology, no problemo. Amends is something else. You know, to make an apology doesn't even necessarily have to be sincere. It's just about me wiggling out. But when I make amends, for the first time in my life, I want to be on the hook. And for the first time in my life, I wanted to not be talking about my dad anymore. That I realized that forgiving my dad was about me finally having a life, for me taking responsibility, for me finally choosing to believe what it says in the family afterwards, which it says, we are sure God wants us happy, joyous, and free. Sure, we are sure God wants us happy, joyous, and free. I'm a temper tantrum girl. Anybody else like temper tantrums? I mean, alcohol, really? Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous would ever have a temper tantrum. Just me and Christina. I'm a temper tantrum girl, okay? And I mean, I swear, like, I promise you, I can have a better one than the little one in the back there. I mean, when I don't want to let go of something, I do not. You know, like, there will be claw marks. But you guys taught me that every character defect, this is 6 and 7, every character defect is character asset out of proportion, right? So I've got to learn how to have spiritual temper tantrums. Thank you. That it says also in the family afterwards that we absolutely insist on enjoying our life. That's the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is all about spiritual alchemy. It's not whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Like I said, I hate that. It's whatever hasn't killed me, you have given me a path for it to make me happier. That we do spiritual alchemy. The alchemists were trying to turn lead into gold. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we turn crap into gold. And when the pressures are really, really high, maybe that's when we just sparkle. We make diamonds. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a path for me to live no matter what's going on. And there's been a lot of goings on. But no matter what, it is my responsibility today to make sure that I'm holding on to God's hand so that I can have this day be what God's asking it to be today. And I am sure that God wants me happy, joyous, and free. So I'm going to have a good night. I hope you will too. Don't make other plans. Woo!